Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today I'm joined by Ingrid Mulgren. She's the Senior Policy Director at Plug In America, the trade association of electric vehicle owners across America. Ingrid's based in Vermont, one of my favorite states, and I'm just delighted to have her on the podcast today. Hey, Ingrid, welcome to the podcast. Great to see you.
Thanks, Ted. Great to see you as well.
It's been a few months. When did we see each other? Was it December for the Plug
In
America?
November.
November even. Okay,
yep,
so we're about 5 months
meeting.
Out. And you're sitting in Jericho, Vermont as we speak, right?
I am. Indeed, I am. It's kind of cloudy out, but getting very green very quickly.
Spring has sprung, huh?
I think you know I
lived in Vermont for many winters, and you're due, right?
It's oh, definitely. Yes. Yeah. We're pretty happy when May rolls around.
Yeah. Did you grow up in Vermont?
I did not. I grew up in Pennsylvania.
So what brought you to Vermont? Was it college like me?
Grad school. Yep. I went to grad school at UVM and just never left.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So I've introduced you as the senior policy director at Plug In America.
Yeah.
And before we get into Plug In America and some of the things that you're working on are broadly, but what's today? You told me you just got back from DC late last night. What's happening this week in your life?
I am part of a coalition. Plug In America is part of a coalition, the Clean Vehicle Campaign. And we have a bunch of members, and they just had a big coalition retreat in Washington, D.C. So
What's the temperature with clean energy vehicles right now? I mean, I see this huge rise, but then I also read in the press that Tesla sales are going down. And what's the temperature generally?
Yeah, it's a bit divided right now, Ted. People who drive them love them, but there are a lot of people who there's a lot of negative media. It gets a lot of clicks, interest, and it's very polarized. EVs are very polarized right now, which is kind of sad because they're great technology, super efficient, have a lot of benefits from the consumer perspective, the driver perspective, environmental perspective, economic perspective. There's so many benefits, but they're very polarized right now.
Yeah.
And I don't expect that to go away right away.
Well, it's interesting that you put it in polarized is an interesting term. And then Bloomberg News came out, I think it was last month, and said, hey, guess what? 32 countries around the world have hit the EV tipping point. And then the article went on to say that, you know, that's been very pronounced in places like Norway and even Thailand, other places. But in the United States, and maybe it was Korea also, there's been that we haven't had the same adoption rate.
So, yes, totally agree. They're globally, EVs are just taking off. Like, even if the United States, for whatever reason, decided we're not doing EVs, which isn't going to happen. Like, the automakers have huge global markets and would not be able to compete globally without electric vehicles. The world is charging ahead. They're, no pun intended, they're going to be driving EVs. I think they're up around 40% in China. It's going to be probably 20% of sales globally this year will be electric or plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. So it's definitely happening. The change is happening. The transition is underway. But I think there's been a lot of misinformation in the media in the United States, and it has become very politicized.
I'm really glad to hear that you have this view, and I, like you said, fundamentally and bottom line, it's really happening. I mean, there's a worldwide transition to electrifying mobility, and the EVs are at the forefront of that. Let's talk about you getting into EVs. I did a little bit of research on you, and in 2016, you're working for Vermont Energy Investment Corporation, and you wrote a paper about the societal benefits of electric vehicles. And that was pretty darn early, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I got into the EV space through energy efficiency and working with utilities. And Vermont we have what's called an energy efficiency utility. So instead of having utilities offer energy efficiency programs, the state decided to add a systems benefit charge on everybody's electric bill, put it all in one pot, and have one administrator do all the efficiency programs for the state. At first, it was contractually based, but then they created this actual energy efficiency utility. So it was a regulated utility. So I've worked with a PUC, and in that sort of regulated regulation environment. And so I worked with energy efficiency. And when you're working with energy efficiency, you're, all the different measures, they need to be able to screen for cost effectiveness. And so they use these cost benefit tests. And so I started working in the EV space and I'm like, wow, I wonder what would happen if we did the same sort of analysis with electric vehicles. And so that's where the thinking was behind that research and that paper. And so just sort of adding up, like, how is it going to impact the grid? How, you know, what are the cost savings to consumers or to drivers? What are the impacts on public health or the social cost of carbon? So yeah, that's where that came from.
Well, I thought it was fascinating and ahead of its time. And you had, I'm just thinking about some of these benefits to human health, air quality, grid resilience, you just mentioned, economic growth, national security, fuel savings. And I know I'm oversimplifying this analysis, but you ended up with like 16,000 benefits or $16,000 of met benefits for each EV compared to each, I guess, ICE vehicle, right?
Yep. And then I did an updated version. Somebody actually who is very active with Plug in America long before I started working here reached out and asked me to update that study. I think in 2019, I think the updated version was published. So yeah, it's certainly still relevant looking at all the different, when you look at the broader societal benefits, it's quite an impact.
It really is. Let's go all the way back. I know you weren't there at the beginning of Plug In America, but talk about what was the genesis of this trade association, which is now, you're 22 years old, something like that?
Yeah, so we've been a national nonprofit for 15 years. So back in 2008, maybe it's 16 years, we became a national nonprofit, a 501c3, the only vehicle in production, electric vehicle that's actually in full production was a Tesla Roadster. This is like years before the model, the Nissan Leaf. This is way back in the day. But the true history of Plug In America goes all the way back to the mid 90s. And you can see in detail in the documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car, really does a great job of documenting basically the genesis of Plug In America. But the gist is that in the mid-90s, CARB required, the California Air Resource Board, required that automakers selling vehicles in California had to make electric vehicles. The automakers complied, but they also put their lawyers to work to push back against the regulation and these rules. And so they made these little compliance cars, the EV1. I think there was like an all-electric RAV4 type vehicle. There were a few electric vehicles. They had pretty small ranges. They were definitely first generation. And so what ended up happening is they would lease these vehicles out. They were really hard to get, super popular, even though their ranges were tiny, like, I don't know, 50 miles or something. And so they ended up having these vehicles out on leases, but then their lawyers won in the suit against CARB, so they recalled all the cars. They wouldn't sell them. People wanted to buy them. They loved their little EVs, and the automakers basically clawed them all back, and I think GM was the one that actually crushed them.
Yeah.
It was very grassroots. All of these protesters were out there, like, we want our electric cars, don't crush them, no car crushing. They had a funeral. Like, it was very creative, very well organized. And some of those same folks are still very much engaged with Plug in America.
Yeah, it's amazing, amazing. You know, when I think I told you this when we got together back in November, that I drove in one of those EV1s when I worked for Los Angeles Department of Water and Power in 1998. We had a fleet of, I think, six or seven of them, and they were just rockets. They just, anybody that's driven an EV knows, it's just not like an internal combustion engine. I mean, you hit the gas pedal on an EV and it just goes. And the EV1, I guess it was originally called the Impact, and they thought that was a bad idea. It sounded like a car crash. But the EV1 was incredible. And you're right, that had a lead acid battery in it, I think, and that only had a range of, you said 50. I think it was 60 or 70 miles. But if you turned on the air conditioner, forget about it. So, yeah, it was terrible that they were all crushed. But so the trade association was founded and has been a voice for all these years.
Yeah, so I don't know if I'd necessarily talk about us as a trade association. We're more of sort of an EV driver association. Still have a lot of those sort of grassroots, very committed to the people who have supported us and continue to support us. And really, we represent EV drivers all over the United States in particular, but all over America. We do a lot of education and outreach, and the goal is really to accelerate EV adoption. And initially, it started out really focused on making sure that there were EVs available after the whole car crashing. We still focus on that to some extent, making sure that smaller, more affordable EVs are available, but very much supporting EV drivers and making sure that accelerating the EV adoption around the country.
I mean, I guess there's always so much more to do with our penetration being, what, in California, maybe 20% now of new cars.
Yeah, I
That's
think
not of
California
all
is up
vehicles.
around, I think it's up around 25% of sales, so one in four
Yeah.
in California, but the rest
So
of the country is a little around 10.
right. So the cup is filling up, right? And if you use that whole metaphor of the cup being
It
half
is, yep.
full, but there's a lot more to do. And I think that was I was involved with facilitating your board meeting, which is fascinating. And it was really interesting to look at the direction that the organization is going, because what would you say that the really the, you don't want to leave anybody behind in this whole groundswell movement, right? You want to There's this whole
Right,
social
right.
equity dimension that's so important.
Absolutely. So electric vehicles have an amazing capacity because they cost less to operate, because they cost less to maintain, because they're less expensive to power. They have an amazing capability and capacity to create a more equitable transportation system. So less pollution. So for passenger EVs, they cost less, but also for transit, for school buses, like definitely creating a more equitable transportation system. Because as you probably know, Ted, that the pollutants from vehicles often tend to disproportionately impact people in lower income neighborhoods and disproportionately impact people of color. So there's definitely a lot of inequity and historical inequity, very systemic inequity in the creation of our highway system. And so as we transition to EVs, we see this as an incredible opportunity to make our entire transportation system more equitable. And because EVs cost less to own and operate, it's really, really important making sure. Plus, electricity is a much more stable fuel source as far as cost. Like, unlike gasoline, which can practically double in price overnight, electricity, it may have different costs at time of day, but if it's well managed, it can be very, very inexpensive. So lots of opportunity for equity to get getting electric vehicles broadly distributed among all populations, making them accessible, available, super important. But that isn't the case right now. we, you know, initially we wanted to make sure EVs were available. And so we're shifting into the space where we really want to make sure that they're available to everyone. And
Right.
so that means making sure that there's lots of accessible, affordable public charging, long dwell time, sort of slow charging in urban areas where the majority of people live in multifamily housing. A lot of people rent, so they don't have the ability to just install a home charger or the place to do it.
Let's talk a little bit about the toughest case, right? It's the lower income person, lower to middle income person living in an apartment, right? With or without parking. That's just a tough situation. So right now, I know that there's stimulus monies, there's tax credits that can support this. I've seen utility programs where they're giving incentives for used EVs, so sort of meeting consumers at the price points they're at. All sorts of funds in California and maybe throughout the country now going into charging. But what are some good examples of areas that have addressed this charging desert or addressed this inequity, like you said? Are there certain cities or cases that you can point to?
So there's definitely not a silver bullet. There's no like one size fits all solution, unfortunately, but there are a lot of very creative, innovative solutions that are being developed in individual communities. So there's everything from changing zoning ordinances so that people can run an extension cord across their sidewalk and
I've seen that,
charge
yeah.
their EV with a regular extension cord right out on the street. There are organizations that are working. I know in the state of California that they're installing EV chargers into apartment buildings free of charge, like they're subsidized, and that there's a cap on what the landlords can charge for charging because of that. So part of the issue is access, so making sure there's access to charging. But another really big part of the issue is making sure that that public charging in apartment buildings or near apartment buildings is the same price that you would pay if you charged at home, because residential charging is pretty inexpensive. Once you get a few middle men involved, it can get quite expensive, and there you lose your benefit, the whole cost benefit of charging.
That's interesting. So there's, is it federal legislation or state legislation that's capping that price
So
that
these
landlords
are
can charge?
specific programs in California that I'm referring to. And so it's part of the program, like in exchange for putting in charging, do also technologies like managed charging so that it really helps bring down the cost of infrastructure upgrades that are necessary. So there's a bunch of different ways to address this. And actually, Plug in America is embarking on a big project this year where we're going to collect all of these case studies, well, a lot of case studies from all over the country and how individual communities are addressing this problem. And we're going to compile them and analyze them, develop best practices, and then put together some stories, do some storytelling, and put together these stories of how these issues have been addressed.
I think that'll be really useful because it's a really big challenge. I like to think about the efficiency world, the solar world, everything was going well until we were told, oh, now we have to include equity. It's like, oh my gosh, it's a quantum leap. You know, part of that is we're working with a city here in California that is bringing in a third party provider. We've taken them through a whole competitive solicitation, bringing in a third party provider to provide almost 100 chargers in the city, a combination of level two and fast chargers. And I negotiated hard with the company to cap that charging price, because as you know, there's a lot of level three charging, DC fast charging that is getting up over 50 cents a kilowatt hour, right? So
Which is
my, I mean, I.
really right on par with the cost of a gallon of gasoline. So when you break it down, like you're eliminating your cost savings when you're paying that much for charging.
So I guess one way of looking at that is when you're on a road trip and you're paying these high prices for charging, it's about the same as if you were a regular car. But if you're at home, right?
Yeah. Exactly. I just went on a road trip and I was surprised. I looked at all my receipts and I was like, wow, that's more than I thought it cost. It's pretty comparable, a road trip. But as a daily driver and commuting, if you can charge at home, the savings are quite substantial.
It's extraordinary. Now, you must be, it's an aside, but you must be pinching yourself periodically. I mean, I think I read recently there's 111 electric vehicle models now available in the United States. Isn't that incredible? We grew up with the EV1s and the Nissan Leafs and the RAV4s, and now every company is producing. I've been struck by Mercedes-Benz. It's got this whole, you know, extensive fleet now, and they're proud of Toyota, which has sort of been resisting it for years. Isn't it incredible?
My poor family, every time we go out, I'm always like, oh, all electric, plug-in hybrid. Like I'm pointing out all the different, but it's getting to the point that it's so frequent that I'm not doing it as much because they're starting. I mean, and it definitely depends where you live, but there are so many on the road and I'm not even sure. Some of them I'm like looking to see if they have a tailpipe.
Yeah, that's because
I'm not
check.
Even familiar with some of the models. So it's really fun to see.
I saw my first VinFast out on the road the other day on my bike ride.
Nice.
You know, beautiful green, dark, you know, forest green color. And, you know, what is that? A Vietnamese company, I think.
It is.
You know,
yeah.
In our market. And it's incredible. And then, of course, the Chinese are just going wild. I wanted to spend some time talking about vehicle grid integration with you.
Sure.
Because as you pointed out in your 2016 paper, and we've talked about, you know, grid resiliency is just an amazing benefit that you get from electric vehicles that, you know, gasoline powered vehicles have nothing to do with the grid. We're really seeing this integration. Well, how fast is this coming on? Maybe you could describe it a little bit for some of our listeners that don't really understand. It used to be called V2G. Now it's VGI.
Yeah,
for some
sure.
Reason.
So vehicle grid integration was really what got me excited about electric vehicles in the first place. Like I came from that background where I worked with a PUC, was very focused on the grid and efficiency. And basically electric vehicles are essentially storage, they're energy storage, which is always a challenge with the grid. You've got to use electricity as you're producing it. And being able to have all these mobile sources of storage, it's just like this great big puzzle. And depending on how you use it and when you charge, and it just has so much potential to be able to create more efficiency to the grid and actually put downward pressure on rates. So it's pretty remarkable. And that's really what got me hooked on EVs. It's just their amazing capacity to support the grid, create more resiliency, and help incorporate and integrate renewables with the grid. So they're pretty amazing.
So dumbing it down, you have your car plugged in at your home, right?
Yep.
And then if you subscribe to a utility program, you would allow the utility to automatically draw power from your battery and your EV at certain times, right? Leaving whatever cushion you want for your next day. That's sort of the way it works, right?
There's all different levels of vehicle grid integration. So a lot of times people say VGI and they assume there's bidirectional charging involved, or in your case, controlled or managed charging based on the example you gave. It could be as simple as time of use rates. So your utility might have zero control over your car or when it charges, but they just may introduce, they know when the grid has a lot of load and when it doesn't. So they can just introduce rates that make it much cheaper for you to charge when they have additional capacity on the grid. And so being able to charge, you know, midnight to 5 a.m. or in California, you have that duck curve. So right in the middle of the day when you're getting tons of solar, their cost of electricity at that time, I understand that some utilities are paying to offload that because there's so much power on the grid. So being able to plug in 100,000 EVs and have them all charging during that time is actually saving them money, saving the utilities money. So just even having pricing that reflects that, some places you have off-peak charging that's free. So you think about this kind of opportunity, or, you know, maybe it's a less than a dollar per gallon equivalent. Like, you think about these kind of opportunities and then you think about equity and you say, wow, if there are people who are struggling with mobility and they can get into an EV that requires like almost no repairs or maintenance, you don't have to schedule around your job or bring your kids with you to the oil change or the maintenance, like they're just so low maintenance. And then being able to have programs or opportunities through utilities where you could charge for very, very little, could really, really help economic mobility for people through actual transportation mobility.
I'm glad that's well put. I'm glad you've broadened my perspective on VGI now, because I always think of it as the bidirectional charging, but there's lots of other ways that we're effectively integrating EVs into the grid. I love the bidirectional charging. I love the notion of being able to, you know, I love the notion of driving my electric vehicle to the airport, plugging it in somewhere. I'm gone for a week and the whole time the utility is paying me for the use of my battery. And I know some people are going to say, wait a second, you're going to void the warranty on the battery. You're going to go through too many cycles. I think that's all going to get sorted out. But I just love that notion of another source of revenue. And even at home where, you know, what's a Tesla Powerwall is 13.5 kilowatt hours. Our Chevy Bolt has 65 kilowatt hours on board. Our little Tesla has, I think, 72 kilowatt hours on board. So what's in your vehicle tank is much greater than what you would get with a Powerwall, right?
Oh, certainly. And I think, you know, these natural disasters and these big storms, power outages, and people plugging in their F-150 Lightning and powering their home off of it. So yeah, there's just so much opportunity to really just sort of plug all these pieces in, again, no pun intended, and make the grid more efficient, more resilient, and more affordable.
So we've danced around this a little bit, but what do you think right now are the biggest challenges to EV, you know, EV adoption? I have a bet, by the way, with a good friend of mine back in New York. I think I made the bet last year, and I bet him that he and his wife would both be driving EVs in 5 years. And I said everybody will be driving EVs in 5 years. I know I'm too optimistic, but what do you see as the obstacles at moving forward?
Yeah. So, oh boy. Okay. So the sort of really concrete ones are, I think the biggest one, the umbrella one, is education. Change is scary. People don't know what to expect. A lot of people, the idea of they've grown up pulling up to the pump every week, gassing up their car. So people just have certain expectations. And so the idea of that scale of change, this is a big disruptive technology. And change is scary. So I think the biggest one is just education, just understanding how it works, being familiar. But the more like concrete examples, definitely building out the grid, addressing equity by making sure that chargers are available at similar costs to everyone, so that not having a lot of upfront affordable EV models. Like, you and I know that over the life of the vehicle and as you're using the vehicle, it's going to cost a lot less than a gas car. But seeing that upfront sticker price, there's not a lot. The Bolt has been discontinued temporarily, and there's not a whole lot that has filled in and taken its place. It was the third best-selling EV in the United States last year. And the other ones tend to be a little more expensive.
You think I should renegotiate my bet with my friends back in New York?
I think it's optimistic, but I wouldn't. I don't know how much you bet. So I guess it depends how much you bet. But And I don't know your friends. So there's a lot of variables I do not have the answers to on that one. But I do think that the politicization of electric vehicles is an issue. Just nobody's coming to take away your car. Like, there will still be plenty of gas cars out there. But I do think that ultimately the technology is far superior. There are so many benefits to driving electric. The driving experience is so much better. The ownership experience is so much better. And I think that all of the manufacturers have made commitments. There's been lawsuits about the California waiver, and they aren't going anywhere because there's essentially no plaintiff. The parties that are impacted are their automakers, and they're not opposing the EPA standards or the California waivers. So it's definitely happening. I think in 5 years, there's a very good chance that your friends will both be driving electric vehicles. They would
Thanks,
be
Ingrid.
lucky if they are. You'd be
They
better
will
off
be
if they
lucky.
are.
They maybe before 5 years. Come on, I know. Once you drive an EV, you do not want to go back. You really don't want to go
Right,
back.
right. Yeah, time and time again, 90% of our, at least 90% of our drivers, we conduct an EV driver survey and people love them and don't want to go back.
It's fantastic. Hey, thanks so much for being on the podcast, Ingrid.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Great talking to you, Ted.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.